Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Southern Alberta Council of Public Affairs. We've had a lot of excitement with our room change in the last half hour. Today's program is titled Beyond the Wire, Advancing Civil Society in Afghanistan. I'd like to acknowledge our sponsors, including Shaw TV, the University of Lethbridge, Lethbridge Herald, and, of course, Erickson's Restaurant. Shaw TV is not able to videotape the presentation today because of other commitments, but as you see, there is an audio recording, and it will be posted on the SACPA website. A bit of bookkeeping first. I just want to remind people to put $8 in the baskets on the table to cover the cost of lunch and use of the room. The format of the presentation will involve the speaker presenting material for 25 or 30 minutes. We'll then break for lunch, and then we will reconvene at 1 o'clock for a question session. Okay. So it's my pleasure to introduce today's speaker, who is Janice Eisenhower. Janice is the president, treasurer, and a co-founder of Canadian Women for Women in Afghanistan. This organization is a Canadian-based human rights or internationally recognized human rights organization that tries to establish opportunities for education, health care, and basic human rights for women and their families in Afghanistan. Janice holds an honors degree in international development from the University of Calgary, and she's published several articles on the topic of peace and security in Afghanistan. Janice and some other members of Canadian Women for Women received the Peace Medal from the Calgary YMCA in the international category. And more recently, Janice herself was nominated for the Heart of Calgary Award for outstanding work as a volunteer. And I saw a newsletter in which members of her organization described her activities, and they were just amazed at the tireless way she's devoted herself to this organization and these issues for over 9 years as a volunteer. So I would now like to ask Janice to come to the podium. I'd like to invite you to give her a warm welcome.
Thank you very much, Susan. And thank you all as members of SACPA for inviting me to present today. I'm very pleased to be here. We'll do just one more mic check if I could. Can everyone hear me in the back all right? Yes, thank you. Beyond the Wire, Advancing Civil Society in Afghanistan. Like me, you may have heard this term, beyond the wire, from our military in Kandahar. It conjures up images of high barbed wire fences, blocked off, a no man's land, insecurity, dust, danger, and fear. But that life beyond the wire is life for most Afghans every day. Yet we hear very little mention of the individual Afghan and their security concerns. Where, for example, are the crises of women's human rights fit? Where do they fit in Canada's goals in Afghanistan? For women, security is more than just the presence of soldiers, barbed wire, and barracks. Security is about whether girls are safe walking to school, whether women can venture to their fields without risk of stepping on landmines, and whether women have appropriate representation in the legal system. It's about an end to grinding poverty, sexual abuse, and the stifling of women's voices. It's about the difference between just surviving and living with dignity and respect. Ottawa's decision to send Canadian troops to Kandahar has garnered a new debate over the role of the Canadian military in this part of Afghanistan, where a vicious insurgency war rages on. Unlike traditional peacekeeping missions, Canadian troops are combatants. They're part of NATO's force taking over from the Americans. So far, Canada's debate has narrowly focused on whether the mission presents an unnecessary... Sorry, are you getting feedback there? Whether it really causes an unnecessary risk to our Canadian troops. The focus on defense in the debate has caused the word security to equate only with a military presence and a perspective from the military. The broader meaning of security is, and how it affects the lives of average Afghan people has really been left out of the debate. That's much to the detriment of a further understanding of our objectives in Afghanistan. While Canada's contribution to military forces is most welcome, it is not sufficient on its own to address the challenges that women and girls face. It must be complemented and enhanced by other forms of assistance, including funding for women's organizations. The important work of individuals, local and international nonprofit organizations who are struggling to develop active civil society in Afghanistan must also be supported. Through our military coverage with the media, we're beginning to be introduced to what Afghan people's lives are like, and it's a very complex history, as we know. Here are a few images that are not typical on what we see in the news, rarely seen when Afghanistan was once described as a trekker's paradise. It was a country relatively at peace, world-renowned for its residents' hospitality, a rich culture and history. Also little known is the fact that in urban centers in, say, the 1970s, more than 70% of teachers, 40% of government workers, and doctors were women. These are more the typical images that we equate with Afghanistan. War destroyed Afghanistan's infrastructure and resulted in the death and displacements of millions of its residents. A recently published book by 60 Minutes veteran correspondent George Creel, it's entitled Charlie Wilson's War, gives the shocking insights into the largest ever U.S. CIA covert-funded operation in Afghanistan during the 1980s, where $500 million a year went towards the Afghan freedom fighters and purchased arms and during the Soviet invasion of the 1980s. When the Soviet army withdrew and the American support ended, there remained a legacy of heavily armed and trained warring factions, millions of landmines, and no real legitimate government to run the country. This gave rise to the infamous 5 years under the brutal rule of the Taliban. Since the fall of the Taliban, the situation for women in Afghanistan has been very slow to improve. Warlords have similar oppressive attitudes towards women as those of the Taliban, and they retain control of many areas outside the capital city of Kabul. Afghan women throughout the country continue to suffer under crushing poverty and oppression. There have been, however, positive steps forward for women. While there are still main huge barriers for education, schools reopened in March 2002 for girls for the first time in 6 years. A democratic election was held last fall, and the debate and challenging process of further democratization is unfolding, which provides some promise of greater strides for women. More than 25% of the elected parliamentarians are women, exceeding the 23% quota for women candidates, and far exceeding women's representation in many Western countries, including Canada. Despite death threats and assassination attempts, Afghan women continue to fight for the right to be represented in the parliament. And while there are hundreds of women in parliament, they sit alongside with warlords and mujahideen, the freedom fighters from the Soviet period, who are also members of parliament, many of whom have committed atrocious crimes against humanity. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International have documented the intimidation, threats, and attacks that women parliamentarians have faced while exercising their right for political participation. These organizations have also documented how life for ordinary women in Afghanistan is far from being free of violence and fear. The Taliban and their misogynist edicts may be gone, but girls and women are a long way from realizing the rights they are guaranteed under the new Afghanistan constitution. The new central government has little reach beyond Kabul. In many parts of the country, women are subject to customary law and often harmful practice, such as child marriage, the selling of brides, and the practice known as BAD, B-A-D, where women or girls are given in marriage to another family as a means of settling a blood feud. Wife and child abuse is rampant, and sexual violence common. Self-immolation has reached unprecedented rates in Western Afghanistan. This is a last resort for many women who see no way out of abusive marriage. Here's the story of 18-year-old Hamidi in Herat in Western Afghanistan. Her family sold her for the equivalent of about $1,200 into a forced marriage with a man she had never met. She moved to the city from the city to a village where her new husband never allowed her to leave the house. She was beaten and threatened as little more than a servant, taken the orders from her in-laws. In desperation, she poured cooking oil over her head and chest and set herself on fire. Although her Maddie survived the ordeal, she did it because she just didn't care about her life. She said it was a kind of final protest against the pressures and the daily abuse. Deep down, she knew that if she was killed, she would be free of the violence. And if she survived, she would still be free, since the family would have nothing to do with her, given her scarred, disfigured body. Another example of the violence was last year in April when Bibi Hamina, a 25-year-old woman accused of having an affair, was stoned to death in the province of Badakhshan. The following month, three Afghan female aid workers were hung in the province of Baghlan. It's obvious that security remains a fragile work in progress. The Taliban are not the only perpetrators of human rights abuses throughout Afghanistan. And insecurity extends far beyond what we see on our nightly news of the insurgency activities in Kandahar. In most parts of the country, women do not have access to any form of legal assistance, and court rulings rarely favor women. Women like Hamidi are imprisoned for running away from abusive families or refusing arranged marriages or eloping. The courts are dominated by conservative figures who rarely rule in favor of women. Police are insensitive to women's complaints and often refuse assistance, forcibly returning to abusive families or imprisoning them for running away from forced or violent marriages. So how can we as Canadians help? We suggest there are three main ways that individuals can have an active role. One is solidarity. It's not charity, but partners in social justice, standing with women and the men in Afghanistan. Advocacy. Talk about the issue. Speak out. Be engaged. Learn. Ask the hard questions. Solidarity, advocacy, and, of course, fundraising. During our discussion later on, I can share with you some tangible ways that we can be involved, like having a potluck dinner in your home that can raise $750, the approximate cost of a teacher's salary for 1 year in Afghanistan. For now, I want to just take a few minutes and highlight for you what my understanding of the official Canadian involvement in Afghanistan. Our mission in Afghanistan affects the lives of millions of people, Afghan and Canadian, and charts a new course for our Canadian military, diplomatic, and development engagement internationally in what is called a 3D approach. Briefly, on the diplomatic front, Canada established an embassy in 2003. It reestablished relationships with the Afghan government last year, and Ambassador David Spruill recently replaced Chris Alexander at the embassy in Kabul to continue an active diplomatic role. Under defense, we're seeing three levels of engagement in the form of humanitarian assistance, peace support operations, and high intensity conflict. NATO's decision to expand security throughout Afghanistan and Canada's participation in these efforts has been welcome. Currently, there are 2,300 Canadian soldiers deployed for a 9-month rotation in Kandahar under Operation Archer as Canada's renewed commitment to the international campaign on terrorism. In addition to the combat troops, some 200 soldiers have also been deployed as part of Canadian reconstruction team since August last year. These are called PRTs, and they're meant to integrate elements from the Canadian forces, from foreign affairs, from the RCMP, and from CETA, our development agency. The PRT from Canada, which is in Kandahar, is expected to remain until February next year, and it's one of 23 multinational forces of reconstruction teams spread throughout the provinces of Afghanistan. The purpose of a PRT is to improve stability by supporting community development projects and extending the authority of the Afghan government to the outlying provinces. Our soldiers undertake humanitarian tasks such as building schools and improving water supplies. While these civil military projects can earn goodwill with the local people and be seen as very positive back at home, many of the Afghan and international non-government organizations feel that the development work by military troops compromises the neutrality of their aid work. In fact, Doctors Without Borders, MSF, suspended its operations in Afghanistan several years ago after having worked there for 24 years. MSF's decision had been influenced by these PRTs, which they felt had blurred the lines between the civilian and military spheres and placed their staff at undue risk. This is referred to as the militarization of aid, when aid workers must operate under direction and control of the military. Overall, there are calls for much more clarity about civilian and military roles in the provision of humanitarian assistance. We feel our military must provide security to ensure an environment that allows Afghans to meet their basic needs, for them to build a civil society, and for them to carry out their own development and peacekeeping work. The call for debate and discussion by Canadians stems from this lack of clarity on Canada's involvement and how we can ensure our role as Canadians will both honour the work of our military and be sure to meet the needs of the Afghan people. The last of the three Ds is CEDA, our development agency. They've confirmed a commitment to Afghanistan's long-term development and reconstruction with both financial and human resources. What is confusing is why Afghanistan is not therefore listed on one of the 25 countries given priority for our international aid. Before 2001, Canada's assistance was largely humanitarian, typically $10 million per year for basic human needs. Now Afghanistan is the single largest recipient of Canadians' bilateral aid, totaling $656 million between 2001 and 2009. However, Canada's aid is mainly bilateral, government to government, and focuses on the priorities established by the Afghan government. Many in the civil society organizations see multilateral funding being scaled back. Canadian programs working directly with civil society in Afghanistan, and particularly those assisting Afghan women, are at risk under new CEDA funding guidelines. Aid has been discontinued, for example, for the Vancouver-based Impacts Project, supporting Afghan women's radio stations. As well, the highly regarded Care Canada Widows Feeding Program in Kabul is in jeopardy. Since 1996, CEDA has funded CARE's humanitarian assistance for Afghan widows, providing monthly food rations to 10,000 widows and their children, some 60,000 people in total, in Kabul's poorest neighborhoods. The program also provided critical assistance to ensure women receive health education and some form of developing a secure livelihood. Kabul alone is home to an estimated 30 to 50,000 war widows, many of whom are illiterate, have few, if any, marketable skills, and own no productive assets. For many widows, begging and sending their children into the labor market are the only options for survival. Such coping practices create a cycle of poverty in which uneducated children are effectively chained to a life of subsistence, unable to learn skills or trades. Early this year, when CEDA announced that the funding for this CARE Widows Feeding Program would not be renewed, the widows themselves, whose families have no other source of food or income, set to march in the streets of Kabul. Only then, thanks to their protest and their outcry from these women, did CEDA agree to continue the program. We've now learned that only a portion of the funding has been continued to provide basic food for the widows, and it was only extended for 12 months. The funds to help with skills training and income generation are gone. Where is Canada's long-term commitment and vision to advancing human rights and opportunities for Afghan women? And what becomes of the tens of thousands of widows and their children in Kabul when we pull our funding? A tiny percentage of our government assistance funding is directed towards Afghan women and their children specifically, and yet even this is in jeopardy. Currently, the only project funded by CEDA that directly assists Afghan women is managed by Rights and Democracy in Montreal. Their Women's Rights in Afghanistan Fund provides grants to grassroots women's organizations throughout Afghanistan with the aim of supporting women's human rights and peace-building efforts. This is a small, unique, and very crucial program to counter the effects of decades of denial of human rights to women. It's vital that this support continue for the long term to sustain this good work undertaken by Afghan civil society organizations. Few of us as part of the international community are familiar with the hundreds of small grassroots women's organizations in Afghanistan. Afghan female civil society leaders continue to fight against great odds to establish viable and sustainable programs in healthcare, education, skills development, and capacity building. They strongly advocate for full, equal, and active participation in all levels of peace building and reconstruction in their country. We need to remember that Afghan women continue to be the best source of knowledge, experience, and expertise on the issues that affect them. They are, in many cases, the best authority for assessing their own needs, rather than the often predominant perception that they are mere victims. I'd like to introduce you to several of these women and the grassroots organizations they represent. In Kabul, the Noor Education Center is run by young Jamila Afghani. She offers literacy training, computer classes, libraries, and other skills building to women and girls in three provinces in Afghanistan and in Peshawar, Pakistan, where hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees still live. When I visited her in March 2004, she told me a story about how when they first opened their library in western Kabul, they were only getting young boys coming to the library. And so she asked within the communities, what could she do to encourage more young girls to come? And they said they'd have to come with their brothers and make sure that they were safe to get to the library. And so she designed a program where when any boy or young male student would bring a girl student with him, they would be given a star. And when they had, whoever had the most stars each month would get a prize. And within 3 months, they had an equal amount of boys and girls in the library. Another contact we have is in Kandahar. Rangina Hamidi helps hundreds of women through an income-generating program making traditional hand-embroidered scarves. Kandahari women are almost entirely absent from the public sphere. There's no libraries or community spaces and no women in the town square, the parks, or the mosques. Rangina introduced us to many women who, behind closed doors, live in a private world where they enchant each other and their families with their bright clothes, embroidered jewelry, and specialized skills in hand embroidery, henna art, and tea brewing. Their lives are very challenging, however, and they're forced to make difficult choices to protect their families. Recent news reports have talked about what's called night letters. They're left around the town center and in the villages, anonymously pinned to trees or walls. The messages threaten parents who send their daughters to school with death or that their daughters would be harmed. Our friends in Kandahar tell us that this was the topic of their nightly family discussions. Parents were faced with a difficult decision over whether to push on in pursuing their daughter's right to an education or to avoid the very real risk that something terrible could happen to them simply by attending school. In one neighborhood, the brutal killing of a teacher made a father ask, "What good are these soldiers if they can't protect our children and teachers?" Elders in the community met to organize to guard the schools and have men in the village take shifts to walk the girls to school each day. Rangina is now working to start the only library for women in southern Afghanistan, one rare place where women can safely meet and plan activities in this war-torn, deeply conservative region. Lastly, in one northern province in Afghanistan, an elderly woman named Biba Haji Mariam runs a school and hostel for children who have no alternatives for education, food, or shelter. She finances the school from her own pocket and by begging family members and friends to donate to the school's upkeep. There are many, many more stories of these individual Afghan women and civil society organizations throughout the country fighting to acquire funding and resources to provide education and health programs to support women's shelters and orphanages, provide counseling and skills opportunities, all contributing to an independent civil society in Afghanistan. We owe it to the women of Afghanistan to keep the spotlight not only on the safety of Canada's military personnel, but on the Afghan women and children without whom the country cannot succeed in building a peaceful society. This is the dream of the vast majority of Afghan people. A viable civil society and a strong women's movement are powerful antidotes to extremism and conflict. Building a strong civil society is a foundation for peace. Peace not built in response to fears of terrorist attacks, but peace to fulfill the dreams and hopes of Afghan women and their families. These dreams are ones we all share, where our basic human rights are more than words on a page, where every man and every woman is valued, every mother and father can feed their child, and every boy and girl can go to school. This is real peace and security, and a civil society beyond the wire in Afghanistan. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Janice, for a stimulating presentation. We will now break for lunch, and I encourage you to talk about the subject and maybe think of a few questions you'd like to pose for Janice when we reconvene.